Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The sun is now setting on the Obama presidency and already on 7 years of an Obama foreign policy that has been slammed and praised as feckless, as naive, as AWOL, or as wise, as measured, as historic, rightly skeptical of American displays of power. Right now, Washington is abuzz about an article in The Atlantic, a big, long conversation with the president about how he thinks he's done at finding a new footing for this country on the global stage. The president talked for hours with Jeffrey Goldberg about the real Obama view. Goldberg is with us this hour on Point, how the president sees the world. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you a fan or a critic of how this president has poised America in the world and why? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Special welcome today to our newest listeners on Illinois Public Media in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. My old neck of the woods, we look forward to hearing from you. You know the span of messages around the Obama foreign policy. Here was the president himself, May 2013, big speech on counterterrorism strategy at the National Defense University. Said that since 9/11, America had sacrificed a lot and risked sacrificing its principles to wage war on terrorist groups, said it would be a mistake to resort to force to address every threat.
So America's at a crossroads. We must define the nature and scope of this struggle, or else it will define us. We have to be mindful of James Madison's warning that no nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare.
And the pushback, this is fecklessness. This is grade F foreign policy. Here was Arizona Senator John McCain, of course, who ran against Obama in 08, let's remember, talking to The Hill about the Obama foreign policy record. He was blunt.
I don't know. I've never seen a commander-in-chief so oblivious to the events that are taking place in the world.
Joining me now from Washington is Jeffrey Goldberg, national correspondent for The Atlantic, former Middle East correspondent, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, former writer for The Jerusalem Post, The Jewish Daily Forward, and more. His long new fascinating piece in The Atlantic is headlined The Obama Doctrine. It's the talk of Washington's foreign policy establishment and realms beyond. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Jeffrey Goldberg, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thank you, Tom.
Can you just describe how you engaged in this conversation with the president to begin? Where and how did you sit down with him over what kind of period of time?
Well, I mean, I'm lucky in the sense that I've been interviewing him for years, intermittently, since he was in the Senate. I think the first interview I ever did with him was 2006. So, you know, by the time this notion came around, I had this notion that, you know, they're coming to the end of their term, and they, like every president, they want to explain themselves. I guess this sort of developed in the middle of last year. And over the last 5 months, I sat down with him four or five times, mainly in the White House, but also I went on a trip that he took to Asia, and we talked there as well, which is, of course, interesting. I think they wanted me on that trip on purpose because a big part and a big underreported part of his presidency is trying to extract us from the Middle East and point us toward Asia.
Does the president think that the people or people understand what he's up to when it comes to foreign policy?
I don't think so. Certainly people around him don't believe that it's adequately understood. And, you know, a bit of this is funny because he's sort of an open book. I mean, he gives a lot of speeches, and he spends a lot of time on his speeches, as you know. He's a writer. And his team is very interested in communicating these ideas. But I don't think – look, one of the reasons they agreed to do this with me is because I think they haven't felt that their ideas have been ventilated enough. And some of the ideas are sufficiently different from the norm that they're hard to explain. And so I think this might have been the first big pass at this kind of thing. I doubt it's the last.
All right. So we're going to sit back and work through some of the really interesting nuances of what you offer here. But step back with us for a second just to begin and describe for us, if you would, after all these hours,
how this president sees the world and how that's different from many, maybe not all, but many of his predecessors.
Right. Well, the title of the piece, the headline, the cover line, the Obama Doctrine, is a bit inexact, let's say, because what you're talking about in some cases is a president with the with an absence of doctrine.
Many would say he doesn't have a doctrine. He doesn't like doctrine.
Well, you know, the doctrine of no doctrine, the doctrine of take things as they come is also a kind of a doctrine. But there's no Monroe Doctrine here. There's no Truman Doctrine. Mm-hmm. However, I mean, I came to some conclusions after talking to him, and I, you know, probably spoke on the record with him 5 or 6 hours the last few months, and so I got a lot of, you know, I got a lot of firsthand observations out of that.
Yes,
and I would say that there are a couple of things that really struck me. One is that, and I guess we'll talk about it in a minute, the whole Syria red line crisis. Mm-hmm. What came out of that is a real aversion to going to what he refers to as the Washington playbook for these kind of crises, which is a kind of a cruise missile oriented playbook. If country X is a rogue country and it does something, well, we have an arsenal to respond to it. And he is questioning and then questioning again every time somebody comes to him and says, let's hit somebody. He asks the question, why do we have to hit them? And that's – so part of the doctrine is to sort of really pressure test the impulse to get involved militarily. There's another part, which is that he wants to pressure test the desire, the impulse to get involved even non-militarily. You know, he sometimes questions whether interventionism works. And I think he wouldn't put it this way, but I would. I think he thinks that America has the ability to make things better in the world, but in certain cases it has the ability to make things worse. And so you have to We're the 800-pound gorilla, and so when you sort of point us in a direction, you know, boom, get out of the way, because sometimes we're a little bit klutzy about the way we do things. So there's that. Then regionally, I think he believes that, well, for obvious reasons, when he came into office, we had 180,000 troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. He thought we were overweighted in these places. So we all know this because a lot of people voted for him because of this. He wanted to reduce that kind of that presence. But he has come to the conclusion that the Middle East is just not as important as American policymakers have thought it to have been over the past, let's say, 30, 40 years, in large part because we're growing energy independent. And in large part because he feels that the problems of the Middle East can be managed. And coupled with this observation is another observation. It's not only that he doesn't think it's quite as important as other people think, he also believes that our ability to change it is severely limited. So you add these two things together, the notion that you can't fix the Middle East, A, and B, is it really worth America's time, effort, money, treasure, and blood to try to fix the Middle East? The answer is sort of no. And he believes that the president, any president, has limited bandwidth. There are a lot of important places in the world. Asia is a lot more important in his mind. And so his doctrine has been to resist the reflex in Washington that's developed over many decades to believe that we can shape the future of the Middle East.
What is the deep view behind all this that you can perceive, Jeffrey, on maybe on President Obama's view of human nature, but certainly on statecraft itself? How does that differ from presumptions or fundamental compass settings that predecessors may have brought to office?
Well, he is this bundle of contradictions. One of the reasons that he's hard to explain or people have a hard time explaining him is that he's very complicated. So he has this Niebuhrian tragic realism that the evil exists in the world. Reinhold Niebuhr, the theologian. That evil exists and that government can't eradicate evil. And so you have to just accept the tragic reality that bad things are going to happen, and though your impulses might be to intervene and try to stop them from happening, it's not so easy. So there's that, you know. And then he has this kind of Hobbesian observation about the world that that when humans are under pressure or scared or frightful, in the absence of strong government and strong norms and strong systems, they will revert back to tribe. They'll revert back to clan. They'll revert back to kind of building moats and you know what you see in the sort of deterioration of the Middle East. So he has that. On the other hand, he's hope and change, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy was not the people who voted for him first in 2008 didn't vote for him because he was a tragic Hobbesian mm-hmm. Niebuhrian realist, you know.
Right. Absolutely not.
And so he does believe. I mean, he has this kind of sanguine approach, partially because he is cool and rational, right? He has mm-hmm. his affect. He does believe that the world is bending in our direction, and by our direction, I mean toward norms, law-based systems, non-corrupt government, progressive values, anti-tribal, anti-fundamental.
Over a long, long arc, a kind of Martin Luther Kingian scale arc, maybe.
Look, this is a guy, I really do believe this. Maybe it's because of his age, maybe because of his demeanor, I don't know. But he believes that, and again, this is my, I'm writing this onto him because he wouldn't frame it this way. I think he believes that in 15 or 20 or 30 years, people will look back and say, man, that Obama, that was smart. Both the things that he did and the things that he didn't do. That's the important part. He believes that not doing things is as important as doing things sometimes.
And the view that the world is sort of like a bicycle and that the U.S. isn't pedaling really hard all over the place, it sort of falls over and veers to chaos?
He has that too, you know, which this is why the Middle East is such a difficult challenge for him, because he has come to the – so this is one of my conclusions. I only got this, you know, in the sort of the third or fourth round I had with him when I realized that the caricature of him as someone who does not believe in the indispensability of the United States to the world system, that's wrong. You hear that in a lot on the Republican side, mm-hmm. that he doesn't believe America's indispensable. That's right. He believes America's completely indispensable. But he also is the first president I know of who sometimes resents that, who wishes that other people would do something once in a while.
And he sure doesn't always seem to act like that, certainly not in the way that presidents have before, or in the framework of the mythos that we've developed about how American power is deployed. Jeffrey Goldberg, stand by in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Barack Obama's view of the world. It's complicated. As told in a series of long conversations to my guest today, Jeffrey Goldberg, national correspondent for The Atlantic, where his epic piece is headlined The Obama Doctrine. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. It's well worth a read. And you can join us today. Jeffrey Goldberg joins us from Washington. What is your sense? After 7 years of how Barack Obama sees the world, do you see an Obama Doctrine? Do you see a break with the past? Are you on board? Has he set the right course, brought the right attitude? Do you see why Goldberg calls Obama's decision not to bomb Syria after it used poison gas as the president's Liberation Day? We'll talk about that. Here he was, the president back in August 2012, laying down that red line, the famous threat to the Syrian regime and jihadi groups on the ground, that there would be enormous consequences if they crossed his red line on and deployed chemical weapons.
We have been very clear to the Assad regime, but also to other players on the ground, that a red line for us is we start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons moving around or being utilized. That would change my calculus. That would change my equation.
A red line for us, uttered by the American president, and the chemical weapons came, and the red line hammer did not come down. In the time since, all kinds of criticism. You can hear it every day on the campaign trail. Here was Senator Ted Cruz, asked whether or not he cares what the world thinks of the U.S. He says yes, and then slammed the Obama administration in Miami last week.
This administration started with President Obama sending back the bust of Winston Churchill to the United Kingdom within the opening weeks. Then he proceeded to go on a worldwide apology tour, apologizing for the United States of America. Our friends and allies quickly learned America could not be counted on.
Okay. They had a couple of busts. It was on loan. It was headed back anyway. But you get the idea. Bear any burden? Not how Ted Cruz describes this president. A year ago, then Speaker of the House John Boehner said the world is starving for American leadership to meet the challenge of ISIS. But he said America has an anti-war president with no solution.
Where's the overarching strategy to deal with the largest state sponsor of terrorism in the region? Iran, and to deal with ISIL and all of their related groups. As the president admitted the other day, he has no strategy to win.
And John McCain, again, don't get him started. He was asked to grade Barack Obama last month in an interview with The Hill on Obama's foreign policy. Here's the grade he gave the president.
F. Because he came to power believing that the United States should, quote, lead from behind. He believed that we had to get out of conflicts. Well, we can't lead from behind, and he should have learned a long time ago that when the United States gets out of conflicts, that doesn't mean that conflicts end.
Jeffrey Goldberg has sat down for hours and hours with the president and takes us deep into his thinking. He joins us from Washington. Jeffrey, you described the day that Barack Obama finally decided that in spite of the fact that chemical weapons had been used, that 1,000-plus people had apparently been killed by sarin gas, the president decided not to bring the hammer down, and you described that as his liberation day. Give us some of the TikTok of that and frame up that liberation that you see there.
Yeah, you know, it's that's my expression for it. I just feel it was the moment where he sort of felt, you know what, I'm not going to do the thing that everybody expects me to do, which is, again, to go back to this Washington playbook of using military force in a way unilaterally, you know, without Congress's approval, without the apparent approval of the American people, with very few allies, with a very slippery slope before him. That's what he saw. You know, he sees the Middle East as one big slippery slope, and I think he sees Syria as the most slippery of all. So what happened is, that you recall, in 2012, he issued a statement that if he saw Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian dictator, start using or moving around, and I think the quote was a whole bunch of chemical weapons, that that would change his calculus. He didn't say, I'm going to attack him, but everybody took that to mean that the U.S. would respond militarily.
I mean, I don't know what else a red line means. I mean, it has historically meant anyway.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you could – I mean, and you can lawyer this, and Obama certainly has lawyered this,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you could interpret it any way you want. But the generally accepted notion was that they were going to use force, and that's indeed what happened in August 2013, a year later, when there was incontrovertible proof that Assad was killing civilians with sarin gas. The expectation in Europe, in the Middle East, and in Washington was that Obama was moving toward a strike, and indeed he was. That whole week before the August 30th, he was making the argument. John Kerry was making the argument that, you know, this cannot stand, and it was very Churchillian. Actually, it was a very Churchillian moment for the administration because it was about the response to evil.
And then on that Friday,
and by that Friday, he was so filled with doubt about the course, in part because, you know, he really does believe, I believe, that you have to have Congress with you, in part because the British had just opted out. Parliament defeated David Cameron's plan to join this, David Cameron, the prime minister.
Mm-hmm.
But in part, I think also, and this is to me the deepest part of this, in part because he said to himself, okay, so I throw some cruise missiles at Bashar al-Assad, I blow up some air bases, and I do whatever I do. At the end of the week, Bashar al-Assad comes out, declares victory because he's still alive, and then where am I? And again, this is what he's so worried about the slippery slope, and he thinks that no one in Washington sort of thinks through the second order, third order consequences of these kind of actions, that he could have – he was envisioning himself being far more deeply engaged in Syria in, you know, 6 months after that, 3 months, 9 months, whatever, than he would have otherwise been. And his – you know, one of his top goals of his second term was to not allow Syria to become his Iraq, you know, to become become a debilitating, draining quagmire of a war in the Middle East, an unwinnable war in his mind. So the moment where he put the pause, when he hit the pause button for him, and this is what he told me, he said, this is a proud moment. I was proud of that, which of course is, you know, in Washington that landed with kind of a, you know, a big thud because a lot of people around Washington and elsewhere think of that as his weakest moment. Not as a moment that he should feel pride
in. Well, put that in context for us, because right there, he was walking away from a lot of tradition, instinct, playbook, mindset, and that has rattled a lot of people. Even though, you're right, he may well be right. He may not, but he may be. But describe just why that has rattled people so deeply, the framework that he stepped out of at that moment.
Well, let me quote Joe Biden, who's usually on his side on these things. Joe Biden is also allergic to Middle East intervention now. But you know, Biden frequently says inside the administration, great nations don't bluff. If you say there's a red line and if you threaten force, well, you know, you've got to go carry that out. I think John Kerry, the Secretary of State, felt the same way. Hillary Clinton certainly felt the same way. She was out of government by then, but she definitely felt the same way.
And they felt that was the case, even if it would be ultimately costly or even a mistake.
Well, nobody,
there's some fundamental value to the delivering the hammer once you've threatened?
No. I mean, look, Joe Biden, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, they didn't sit there saying, I know it's going to go badly, but we have to do it anyway.
Well,
I mean, it's a, you know, you come with your own biases and your hopes for action. Mm-hmm. They believed, I think, at the time, John Kerry certainly believed that this would be good, that this would ultimately end up in good. Obama's – look, Obama looks at intervention. Obama understands that he's president of the United States because his predecessor intervened one too many times in a Muslim country's civil crisis, right?
And drove Republicans out of favor with George W. Bush wars.
Yeah. And so he looks at that situation and thinks first, where can this go wrong? And I think the people who are saying, hey, you've got to go do this, were thinking, oh, you know what? This could very well go right. So that was the split
so,
in the administration.
Of course, he ultimately went ahead to bring in Russia and with Putin's help to have Syria turn over, get rid of its chemical weapons. You write that history may record August 30th, 2013. That was his liberation day, the day he as the day Obama prevented the U.S. from entering yet another disastrous Muslim civil war, the day he removed the threat of chemical attack on Israel, Turkey, Jordan, or it could be remembered, you write, as the day he let the Middle East slip from America's grasp into the hands of Russia, Iran, ISIS. How's it look now? We're getting on 3 years on.
Yeah. Well, okay. So it's a bit of a mixed picture, right? On the one hand, he achieved something almost miraculous. You know, in the weeks after that red line debacle, whatever you want to call it, he managed with Vladimir Putin to arrange for the extraction of most of Syria's chemical weapons. And in an irony that people who study the Middle East will understand pretty readily, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, who is obviously has a contentious relationship with Obama, thought this was the greatest thing that happened. You know, I mean, the chemical weapons in Syria were developed for use against Israel.
Yeah.
Right. They were meant to slaughter Israelis. And so Netanyahu looks and says, wow, Obama somehow managed without war to remove the chemical weapons. This is a great gift not only to Israel but to Jordan and Turkey as well. So on the practical level, President Obama achieved something without going to war that George W. Bush didn't achieve in Iraq with going to war. I mean, Bush was looking for chemical weapons that no longer existed, as it turned out, by the time he went to war. Obama got these weapons out without war. So that 10, 15 years down the road, we might say, wow, that was a genius move, right? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, non-intervention has a price. We're entering the world of counterfactuals here. And so it's impossible because we all bring our own biases to these counterfactuals. But here's a plausible counterfactual is that our hesitance, our unwillingness to delve deeper into the Syria conflict when it was still a more manageable conflict left us off the playing field when the battlefield could still be shaped in a way. This is why once I asked him, this is back in 2013, I guess, I asked him, does he regret not doing more earlier for the rebels? And he didn't like that question. And he said, look,
sure
the idea that, you know, these rebels were going to win against Iran and Hezbollah and the Assad regime, that's farcical. But clearly, you know, without deeper American intervention, you have. I'm not suggesting causality, but what you have now is disintegrating states. You have Libya as a new ISIS haven. You have ISIS and other groups spread across Iraq and Syria. We're rolling them back at a reasonable pace. But you have a general collapse of order across the Middle East, and that's something that he'll be handing his successor. And I don't think he wants to hand his successor quite the mess that he was handed by his predecessor.
A different kind of mess, maybe. Jeffrey Goldberg.
Totally different kind of mess, but a mess.
Right. Goldberg goes big and deep with the president in the Atlantic. The Obama Doctrine is the peace. Jeffrey, lots of callers for you. Let's go to Jeffersonville, Indiana. Jerry's calling. Jerry, you're on the air with Jeffrey Goldberg.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say that, you know, I'm a disabled 65-year-old vet.
Okay.
And I very seldom ever agree with anything Obama does as far as him not being able to or not wanting to go into Iraq and fought with them people. You know, I don't think we should have been in there to start out with either.
Okay.
But I think he's turned America in from an 800-pound gorilla to a 150-pound chimpanzee in the world. That's the eyes we got. You know, if you say you're going to do something, you have to do it. If you don't do it, then people don't have faith in you doing anything you say.
What about the record of Afghanistan, where we're still in there, and you can see it's still going to be hard to really get out? About Iraq, that we you know, it's back in trouble. About Libya, we went in, and now we've got kind of a chaos in Libya. Is that a counter lesson to the view that we want to be an active 800-pound gorilla, Jerry, or not?
When you go in here, when you look at two things, Russia was in there. Russia don't care if they kill your family, your kids, your mother, or does. You know, when Russia went in and they couldn't do it, and we go in with some kind of standards, you think you're going to do something that they couldn't do? Come on, be realistic. There's got to be people in there that are smarter than me, and I had enough sense to figure that one out. Russia goes in with no conscience whatsoever. And if you kill one of them, they kill 50 of you.
Is that what you want the U.S. to be? Is that what the U.S. has to be, or you want it to be, Jerry?
No, sir. I want us to have enough sense to realize if they can't do it being with no standards at all, what makes us think we're going to go in there with standards and actually win that war? You're putting yourself into something you're never going to get out of. You'll be in there for 15 years, and it'll still be exactly what it was when you left.
Jerry, we've got it. Whether going in with no standards means you come out a victor, no doubt an open question, certainly for Barack Obama going in at all. Let me get one more, and I'll take it to Jeffrey. Mary Gordon in Austin, Texas. Jerry, thank you. Mary Gordon, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just have a comment, and it is that I love the way Obama has done this and when to go in and when not to go in. It reminds me of Willie Nelson. You know, from Texas, I have to speak up for music and politics.
Okay, what's the parallel? Where do you get that, Mary?
The parallel is Willie Nelson, one of the finest guitar players in the world, has often been cited that he knows when not to play. And if you notice, his music has lots of pauses in it.
Yes, it does.
And I think Obama and Willie Nelson are alike in that way, that Obama has known when not to play.
Mary Gordon, I so appreciate your call as well. Really appreciate it. That's a beautiful parallel, whether everybody buys it.
I love that, Tom.
Yeah. When not to play. Okay. What about it?
I'm going to steal that.
Okay. Consider it stolen, Mary. Mary Gordon in Austin. Jeffrey Goldberg, there you got two views. He's turned us into the 150-pound chimp. He's the Willie Nelson who knows just how to make the music.
Well, I would look. I don't think we can. On the first point, I don't know if we can settle that question right now. We don't.
It's
we
pretty
don't
big deal.
Know.
It's all over the campaign trail.
Credibility is a very hard thing to measure, you know. And I think that look. I don't think anyone disagrees. I don't think anyone disagrees that this moment in Syria was done in a very messy kind of way. I don't think and I think that people understand that there was a credibility issue. But on the other hand, to go to this Willie Nelson point, you know, you have to think about the bad things that didn't happen because we didn't go in also. You know what I mean? And just in terms of the deployment of troops, the deployment of resources and overextension in places that Obama's made a big bet that these things don't matter as much as we think, and that American core American interests are not always involved in the Middle East. And so I think we're in a period that I hate to cop out on both your callers in a way, but I think it's just too early to know.
And it's all right. I mean, you described a collapse of order that he's handing off. He got handed off big wars that Americans were tired
but. Yep. So Mary has the Willie Nelson doctrine. I have the Carly Simon doctrine.
Okay.
You know, we're so vain. We think the Middle East is about us, you know.
But he does not.
I think what he comes with, I've had this for several years now, someone who writes about the Middle East. I don't think it's as much about us as we think. And furthermore, I don't think that our engagement in there can necessarily change things. They're working out some pretty serious stuff in the Middle East, and whether we're there or not, I don't know if it matters.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. And enter offer code ONPOINT at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Barack Obama's view of the world. It is complicated, looking at it as told in a series of long conversations to my guest today, Jeffrey Goldberg, national correspondent for The Atlantic. Got an epic piece there right now headlined The Obama Doctrine. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. It is a great and illuminating read, a great and illuminating sort of dialectic with the president of the United States, a very particular president. Jeffrey Goldberg is with us from Washington. You can join us. What do you think is the lesson of Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya, that we should holster our guns and sit back a little here? Does the president, to you, look wise or feckless? Is the U.S. a better country? Is the world a better place, more realistic, when the U.S. doesn't lean in, come down quite so hard, or not? Jeffrey, you describe Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama getting into it at one point, where his kind of organizing principles sometimes seem to be don't do, let's say, stupid stuff. He uses a little more colorful word there sometimes. And she was quoted as saying, you guys published this, that great nations need organizing principles, and don't do stupid stuff is not an organizing principle. You report that Obama became very angry at that. What were the two meeting views there and how they get worked out?
Right. Well, you know, it's funny. I was the one who interviewed Hillary Clinton on that. And and when she said that, you know, I thought to myself, oh, that's a bit of a brushback pitch. I mean, look, I know that dispositionally they are different. You know, she has a bit of a more of a bias toward action, especially in the realm that we're talking about, the greater Middle East, than he does.
I mean, that's a big deal right now. She was very let's go into Libya for sure.
Yeah, you know, and one of the interesting things in my conversations was, you know, we talked a lot about Libya. I talked a lot about Libya with the president, and, you know, he said, quote, it didn't work, end quote. I mean, he made it very clear, you know.
It was on his watch, but
he went down the path. He went down a path. A lot of people around him wanted to go. The allies certainly wanted to go. European allies wanted to go. All the Arab allies wanted him to go. And so he tried to, in his mind at least, obviously there's criticism of this, in his mind, he tried to organize it in a proper fashion, and it still didn't work. I think that helped lead him to an even greater kind of sense of fatalism about the Middle East and about America's role in the Middle East. But back to Hillary Clinton, you know, she I think this is the basic. This is the basic split. You know, what are the costs of action versus the cost of inaction? And I think she. You know, we're not going to hear a lot about this because they're very unified right now. Right. They have a common purpose in the next few months. Mm-hmm. But I think she generally thinks that he is too hesitant to use force in certain circumstances, and that again, this is me putting words in her mouth. This is not the way I think she would frame it. But there's a chance that she believes that he has overlearned the lessons of Iraq, and that you can't apply the Iraq template to every situation in the world.
America was born being warned of foreign entanglements, but it was also born with this sort of sense of high idealism. And how does fatalism sit with that? It clearly rubs a lot of conservatives, but not only conservatives, really wrong to imagine a foreign policy driven by fatalism.
Well, I mean, let me say, I don't think that the foreign policy is itself driven by fatalism. I think that here's the way I do it in the story, okay? Mm-hmm. So there's five consequential regions of the world. Asia is our future. He's endlessly hopeful about Asia. Half the people of the world, great economic opportunity for the United States, big challenges, of course, but also great hope. Africa and Latin America, two regions that are hopeful and that we should be paying a lot more attention to. Europe. He is not romantic about Europe. He's a child of the Pacific, after all. Mm-hmm. But he understands that Europe is a stable platform from which the United States can influence the rest of the world. And the Middle East is a place where he thinks because he thinks that we can't fix it, that it's working its way through some problems that might take a generation, that we can't afford to waste too much time and energy and effort trying to fix it. I don't know if that's look. This is the thing. I, at one point, I asked him, "Are you being fatalistic or realistic?" And obviously, the answer he gave is realistic. I don't think he's fatalistic. I think he's if you take the long view, you know, I mean, what did George W. Bush say? In the long run, we're all dead. I don't mean that level of long view, but if you take the long view, he believes that situations will work themselves out, and in the meantime, we have to do some things that we can do short term to benefit us and our economy directly.
And he's not worried about the world going to hell in a handcart while the
he
U.S.
is. He is. Like I said, he's a gambler. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a gamble. I mean, he believes that it's under control, and obviously his Republican opponents, among other people, don't believe that it's under control. And in the fullness of time, we'll find out whether he was right or whether he's wrong. Again, I go back to this, and I hate to lean on this because it sounds like a politician, but it's too early to tell. We don't know.
Let's go to Glenn, calling from Lunenburg, Massachusetts. Glenn, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate this article in The Atlantic immensely. Very insightful, and I think if people really read it and understand it, they will realize that President Obama has made the right decision here. Leaders are paid to lead, taking into account all information up to the last minute even, and we don't have to do anything because someone says we have to do it. And I think he made the right choice. We are not in control in the Middle East by any means. And if you look at history, we haven't been in control. And nonviolence is the way to go. Violence is obsolete. And I say, go, do it.
And you don't worry about that leading to things spinning out of control. You're saying we weren't in control in the first place.
The Patriots say, hold your fire and wait till you see the whites of their eyes. That's what we need more of in our foreign policy. And before we put our resources and our precious soldiers in harm's way, we have seen an incredible 15 years of warfare, endless warfare. And by the way, endless warfare will surely lead to the demise of the United States of America.
Glenn, I appreciate your call. Whites of their eyes, Jeffrey Goldberg. One notable thing about this administration is despite his reluctance to get engaged in lots of ways, very little, I mean, there may be reluctance, but certainly a big willingness to use drones. Speaking of whites of their eyes, they can see down from on high. And he's assassinated lots of people all over the place in lots of ways, drones first of all.
Yeah, I always find it amusing when people think of him as someone who does not employ violence in service of our national security. I would judge President Obama to be the greatest terrorist hunter in the history of the presidency. Right now, we're operating in at least 8 countries, killing people. Killing people, he believes, his administration believes, pose a direct threat to the safety and security of Americans. 150 people were just killed by the United States last week in Somalia. You know, I mean, it's one
attack. It's amazing.
That was one attack. I think the only people who have a proper appreciation for this are the people on the left who don't like him for his very let's say very militant policies on this. Part of the reason he doesn't get credit or enough blame, however you want to frame it, for this, is that a lot of this stuff is done in secret. Mm-hmm. Obviously, part of the reason is he doesn't want to talk about it. He's not the sort of person who went into the presidency hoping that he would have to be engaged in 10 firefights a day, yeah, fighting terrorists, yeah, in 8 or 9 different locations. But it is one of the ironies to me is that this guy who Republicans sometimes refer to as almost a pacifist, anti-American, whatever, is out there, you know, day and night basically ordering extremely violent actions in the defense of the United States.
Steve in Lincoln, Nebraska. Steve, you're on the air with Jeffrey Goldberg.
Thanks, Tom. Basically, I just want to say, my perspective is coming out of just getting out of special operations in the military. And I actually believe that he does have a foreign policy doctrine in that he's just a strategic thinker in regards to each, you know, military decision he makes. Good example, operation that took place in taking out Osama bin Laden. You know, the time and the process is just a perfect example of the decision-making process that he makes in regards to everything that he does on foreign policy. I do think it's a doctrine in that he doesn't generalize a country or the people in that country, but he thinks specifically about the people there, and he's more sensitive to them and their country, because no country becomes great unless the people in that country make their country great.
Steve, you're just out of special ops. Do you think this ultimately leads to a more orderly world? We've seen a lot of disorder, even under this president. And in that more orderly world, if it does, what's the place of the U.S. if it's leading from behind or in the Obama style?
Well, I think that we aren't leading from behind, but I think he has seen how boots on the ground in mass Iraq, in Afghanistan, how we're transitioning into a different era. And there is a potential because, you know, under his belt, he's increased special operations and decreased maybe more of the policing side of the idea of doing that in the foreign prism. But basically, I've just appreciated it, having been under special operations, being involved in different operations, and seeing his leadership trickle down to, you know, even to my job when I was in, and the actions that we took. They weren't fickle. They were specific, goal, mission specific, and, you know, there was a prosecutorial process and strategy behind it. We weren't just policing the desert.
A scalpel, not a sledgehammer. Steve, I really appreciate your call out of Special Ops there. Let me get one more, and I'll take it to Jeffrey Goldberg. Matt in Viroqua, Wisconsin. Matt, you're on.
Hi, Tom. So I'm shocked right now at the rise of Donald Trump, and really disheartened by it. And I blame our current president to a certain degree. I feel that, especially on the right, but also on the left, that people feel he's kind of degraded our standing on the world stage. And I, especially on the right, feel that they think America is seen as weak as opposed to before President Obama took office. And I think for that reason, Donald Trump has a lot of support, because his one point is that he wants to make America strong again, quote unquote.
Matt, let me grab it right there and take it to Jeffrey, because I think we have it. And Jeffrey, I mean, if you sit all the way back and look strategically, I don't know. Mm-hmm. No one knows what's going to happen. But if Obama's policy leads to an American perception of loss of standing, loss of authority, power, that puts a Donald Trump in there who promises already to put 30,000 troops in against ISIS and, you know, wants to bring the old swagger back, how does that reflect on the Obama strategy?
Yeah, well, you know, this has been, I mean, this is one of the critiques of Obama, is that he's too cool and rational about these decisions and about the fears that Americans have about terrorism, for instance. I don't know if it's possible to link the rise of a Donald Trump to a 8-year presidency of Barack Obama. I would say this, though, generally speaking, is that we have this kind of bipolar relationship with our foreign policy in this country. We toggle all the time between two extremes, either sort of, militant interventionism or a kind of then we have regrets, and then we move toward a kind of modified isolationism, and then we try to if you listen to Donald Trump or others, you know, then we're back in every fight, you know, and mm-hmm. it would be, I say this just as a citizen, it would be nice to have a little bit more consistency and a little bit more stability in the way we make these policies and carry them out, and if we understood them in longer time frames than we do.
Can the old lean-in, big-hammer policy come back just as simply as the campaign trail rhetoric suggests? New president, and we're back in that, you know, big global straddling posture, old
right.
style?
Well, remember events. You know, what they always say, events. Mm-hmm. If we have, God forbid, you know, another series of terrorist attacks, if Europe becomes more unstable because of refugees, for instance, that's a direct national security threat mm-hmm. to the United States. There are many, many reasons why we might find ourselves more deeply engaged in the Middle East in the coming years. But again, you know, you have to look. Obama at his best does the following. He says, okay, we're in a crisis. What is the thing that we would do in a panic finds out the answer to that and says, okay, let's skip the part where we do the thing that we do in panic and let's think through what the steps after the panic would be. That's not satisfying to some people, and it has obvious flaws, but it is his approach in the post-Bush era.
What do you think of the odds that the Obama doctrine, define that however you like, the Obama style, goes on after he leaves office, is out a year from now?
I mean, you've just asked the crucial question. That's the $64,000 question. Is this period aberrational, or is it a sign of things to come? I think he's probably shifted the window a bit in terms of what is acceptable and what is not. I think most presidents who would follow him would say, you know what, I do want to apply more rigor and to these questions, and I want to take a pause. But I do think that most of the people running for president on both sides of the ledger are probably, after 8 years of Obama, thinking more about the positive sides of more action rather than the prudence of how they would what they might think of as Obama inaction.
You describe him as so self-assured, so rational, and so alone. Is this foreign policy? Is this worldview a product, you know, of a party of one here? The very particular life of Barack Obama.
Yeah, well, you know, somebody asked me a couple of days ago, who makes foreign policy, you know, in America? And I said, the foreign policy is made between in the space between Obama's ears. I mean, that's it. Everybody else is carrying out the foreign policy, but these are his ideas, and he has an awful lot of confidence in it. Too much for my taste, but I think most politicians are too confident about the things they believe. He is alone, and he is sure that in 20 years, or reasonably sure, that he'll be judged right.
It's a long time horizon. Politics will work out much more quickly than that, and events as well. A really singular president in many ways, with a more international view than almost any, maybe any, that I can recall, Boyhood in Jakarta and all the rest. Jeffrey Goldberg got right into that space between the years of Barack Obama, and it is a fascinating piece of work laying out the president's deep foreign policy thinking. It is in The Atlantic. The story is The Obama Doctrine. Jeffrey Goldberg, thank you so much for being with us today. Great talking with you. Thanks for your work.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.